Okay, if you Google community, one of the first things I did when I found out I was doing this talk, is defined as a group of people living in the same place or having a particular characteristic in common. And as we consider that passage, the people who gathered with Jesus around the dinner table in that account, it's hard to imagine two people with less chance of having common characteristics. Sure, they might live in the same vicinity and both be gathering around Jesus, but they're gathering for very different reasons. And in the culture of the day, their worlds were as far apart from one another as you could get. So we're going to spend some time now considering these two people and how they related to Jesus. So we have the meal's host, Simon the Pharisee, who invites Jesus to eat with him as his guest. Now, Jewish hospitality required that guests, and especially guests of honour, as a travelling rabbi like Jesus would have been, would be treated with great courtesy and every care. Yet when he arrives, even the basic common courtesies are denied him. Now, every culture has different rituals for welcoming guests. I'm sure if somebody comes to your home, you, without thinking, would say, "Come on in, take a seat, can I get you a drink? Let me hang up your coat." These things are so ingrained in our culture that we probably don't think twice about them. And in Jesus' day, the customs required that guests would have a kiss of greeting and they would have water and olive oil to wash with. Only then would somebody say grace and then they would go to the table to recline there, the eldest first. So the omission of these things, the kiss of greeting, the washing of the feet, the oil, it is deliberately designed to communicate to Jesus nothing less than a calculated and pointed insult. And it would be a little bit like if we decided to invite the bishop or the archbishop to join us for the Lent meal that we had last week. But everyone agreed beforehand, okay, when he comes in, no one look at him, no one say hello, whatever you do, do not move up so he has a seat, and we won't do him a name badge either. And if that happened, he would have been well within his rights to either think, "I'm clearly not welcome here, I will leave," and do so, or to sit quietly and try and leave at the first opportunity, having been embarrassed by the experience. But that's not what Jesus does when those common courtesies were denied him. Instead, he goes and confidently reclines at the table. It was an act that declared the utmost place of respect. Only the eldest, only the most revered, reclined at the table first. The others followed suit. It's unlikely he would have been the eldest in the room, at age around 30 or so. And so this would have been completely outrageous to the people around them. Who does he think he is? And if they think that's the worst, then what happens next is almost beyond comprehension for them. Enter the woman of the town, a locally known woman with a history. She's known as a prostitute, and she arrives as an uninvited guest. And this bit has always confused me, because I thought, well, if somebody unwelcome turns up, why wasn't she just turned away at the door? But actually, we have to understand that meals at that time would have been held outside in the courtyard. The notion of private property is a lot less common within their communal culture. So although hosted by Simon, it would have been outside in the public realm of the courtyard. And scholars have concluded that this woman is likely to have heard Jesus proclaim his message of grace for sinners earlier on in the day, and having been moved by it, she is now seeking him to express her thanks, taking an expensive alabaster jar of perfume with her. So when she arrives on the scene, the Pharisees would be in no doubt. One like her simply cannot be considered admittance into the community of faith. It's beyond question. Great compensation for our sins would need to be paid first, and even then, that's unlikely as to whether that would even allow it. And yet, unlike Simon, we see that she withholds nothing from him, from Jesus. Seeing the way in which Jesus is denied the basic greeting, she's distraught. She cries over his humiliation and takes it upon herself to provide those courtesies for him, to honour him. And in doing so, she even lets down her hair to dry his feet from her tears. Now, I really struggled over the last few weeks to find a way of communicating just how inappropriate this gesture was. In that day, women covered their hair. Suffice to say that letting your hair down was only done in the privacy of the bedroom. And a groom would only see his bride's hair for the first time on their wedding night. It was a sort of an intimate pledge of faithfulness to that one person. It was a really good job they never saw any L'Oreal adverts. But the significance of that move, that was a costly move for that woman, especially knowing her history. And she continues to pour out perfume and to kiss his feet. So we have those two in stark contrast to one another. Simon, the host, who isn't a host really, in fact is actively refusing to welcome Jesus. And we have the woman, not even an invited guest, but still she hosted with a generous heart, despite her brokenness. Now, her actions were outrageous to those around, not least because her attention to Jesus were obviously meant to compensate for Simon's neglect of him. And I found myself just wondering at the sheer courage of this woman. I mean, if you think about it, she was a social outcast. She was a prostitute. And in that culture, would she even have had family who would still accept and acknowledge her? Any friends? Or simply co-workers with whom she was competitive with? I imagine it was a lonely world for her. And yet from her brokenness, from her need, she was still brave enough to recognise what she needed, to honour Jesus and to reach out for it despite the intense social pressure. And recognising our needs and reaching out for it is simply something that we're just not very good at in our middle class culture today. But to be part of the community of faith is to share of yourself in your brokenness, to be honest with those around you about where you're at and what you need. The woman needed to thank Jesus for his grace, knowing that he loved her in her mess. And I found myself wondering if I would have the guts to do what she did. Not just to make myself visible in my mess, but to publicly align myself with Jesus in my mess. So I know that when I'm feeling a bit wobbly and in a bit of a mess, then I kind of just prefer to hide away until it's all blown over and the situation's improved. And then I can confidently tell people about it in hindsight when it's been resolved. But actually the example that we're shown, the example we are given, is dramatic love and devotion to Jesus from within our mess, publicly. And I'm sure many of you will have come across the saying that church family is more like a hospital for sinners than a museum for saints. And Jesus' acceptance and affirmation of the woman's touch signified his understanding and acceptance of the costly nature of her gesture. So we have these two very different people gathering around the table with Jesus. We have a broken woman and a righteous man. And Jesus' response is to tell a story. He addresses it to Simon. And it's the two people owing money. One owes 500, the other 50. Neither having the money to pay him back. So he forgave the debts of both. And he asks Simon which of them will love the person more. And Simon correctly replies, the one who had the bigger debt forgiven. Jesus confirms this, saying, yep, you judge correctly, that's right. And then emphasises to the woman, your faith has saved you. Go in peace. And the thing is, when we encounter Jesus, we know beyond doubt that we are accepted and loved by him. The challenge for us, as a community of faith, is that we also accept and love one another, no matter how different they are. Now, for those of you who don't know, I joined St Nick's last year as a ministry apprentice. And as part of that year, I studied on a Christian counselling course. And quite early on in that course, as one of the assignments, the aim was to grow in self-awareness. And we had to consider our own prejudices, how we saw others, the instinctive assumptions we made about them. And as part of that assignment, we had to list in the appendix every type of prejudice we thought we might have, positive and negative towards others. Oh, I'm not going to tell you the number of prejudices that I came up with, but 8.5 pages is a lot, even if it is double-spaced. So bearing in mind that prejudices can be positive as well as negative, so you could have a prejudice assumption that an Italian will serve you a delicious meal, or the prejudiced assumption that a doctor will be trustworthy to keep your confidence. But a negative experience of those things might change those associations into a negative one. In the church family, we are called to cast aside our prejudices and seek to find common ground as followers of Jesus, actively embrace those who are different from us. And I really love I love the fact that before addressing his story to Simon, Jesus asks him, "Do you see this woman?" It's sort of like, I think Simon noticed the prostitute gate crashing his party. But did he see her? Perhaps he was averting his gaze for fear of contamination, even looking at her. And Jesus encourages Simon to look at the woman, just to connect with her on a really basic human level. Simultaneously to that call to shed prejudice, there's a challenge for us to be open, honest, and visible to one another. And yeah, it makes us vulnerable, but it's also what makes us family. And if you've ever been to Soul Survivor, one of the summer festivals, when Mike Pilavachi, one of the leaders, has invited people to make a step of commitment to following Jesus by coming up to the front and praying to begin that journey, he then likes to have a bit of a joke by apologising for not revealing the small print, getting them to turn around and look at everybody else and say, "I'm really sorry, but they're all now your brothers and sisters." And he just reiterates the importance of church family. Church family is of central importance to our faith. There was a survey recently on millennials, vast numbers of them leaving the church, and they were interviewing lots of them to find out, well, what makes you keep going to church? What is it that attracts you to the Christian faith? And one of the answers was really quite interesting. She basically said, well, you can always get a good talk online, and you can always have good worship online. She said, but online friends can't help you move apartment when you need to. Church community matters. It is an important part of our faith. And as a community, we're called to demonstrate God's love in action. Feed the poor, practice hospitality, invite those who can't host you back, beginning with the family of believers. The question is, what does that actually look like in Western society right now? There's a chap called Ryan Cook, and he blogs of his experience doing just this. Every Monday evening, him and his family open their home for friends, neighbours, strangers, literally people he meets on the streets or taxi drivers in coffee shops, to go and eat with them. And it's not a grand plan, it's simple. And he just says, well, it's a concrete way of living out the love and welcome of Jesus. And as he reflected on his experience, he just commented that the table, the dinner table, is a powerful symbol of the world put right. The surface of the table is level. You have to look into people's eyes. And regardless of one's status on the way in, everyone receives equally. It's a leveling act. We said at the beginning of this talk, we said last week, food connects. And hospitality itself is a gift from God. It's an exercise in humility as we receive as guests. And it's also an exercise in generosity as we bless others, as we host. We know the food itself is a gift of God, but so is the time we take to share the meal together. And I know that I am often tempted to treat food as fuel. I find myself consuming it on the move. But recently I've come to realise that actually, when I routinely skip eating lunch with others at work because I have too much to do, I dishonour God's heart for community. When I choose to get the washing up done and take 3 minutes headspace rather than sit with my young nephew and niece as they eat a meal, I deprive both myself and them of knowing greater intimacy, shared memories. Each meal is an opportunity for hospitality and community. We'll be wrapping up and heading to groups shortly, where there are a number of questions on those things, food, Jesus, and community. But I'd like you to take that time in your groups to consider the invitation to embrace the seemingly ordinary act of sharing a meal, and to just reevaluate who and why we invite to our tables. So we're going to end now with a prayer of blessing. May the God who is community be with us as we seek to be a community. May God bless our dreams, and may God shatter our self-made dreams. May God help us to be real and to find depth in weakness and brokenness. May God help us to face and grow through conflict rather than pretend by being nice. May we look at each other through soft eyes and truly respect each other as human beings. May God help us let go of control and the need to fix one another. May God help us discover we are needy in our own souls and give attention to our own hearts. And may God grant us the gift of an extraordinary love that flows from the heart of God and covers a multitude of wrongs. Amen.